It seems Gaddafi's world is starting to crumble around him as longtime loyalists and diplomats are defecting to the opposition. Much of the military is joining up as well, and many radio stations, like the one in Tobruk in eastern Libya, have started to broadcast messages of resistance. NPR's Jason Bobian went to check it out.
Free Tobruk Radio is now broadcasting from the base of its own transmitter on a windswept mountain overlooking the city of Tobruk. Its old studios were torched by Gaddafi's forces after the formerly state-run station announced its support for the revolution. The staff escaped with a few microphones, a mixing board, and some computers. They seized the broadcast tower and got back on the air. Now men in leather jackets swinging AK-47s guard their makeshift studio on the mountaintop. Free Tobruk Radio plays songs written and recorded over the last week by local artists. The music is all about the revolution. This song about the anti-Qaddafi protests that started February 15th says, "How many nights have we stayed up without sleep? We will stay here in the streets until our pains are gone." The station's new slogan is "Freedom or Death." The talk shows are also focused almost entirely on the uprising. Members of the military announced on the station that they were switching sides, and the army, at least in this region, is backing the demonstrators. Station manager Khalid Shatarasgala says just before the huge protests started and the station defected, he'd been ordered by Tripoli to stop all discussions on the air of political, religious, and social issues. Rasgala says under Gaddafi, the press was tightly controlled. At local radio stations all over Libya, Rasgala says, if you went against the government or even thought about doing anything wrong, you would be prosecuted by the regime. He says in every station there were one or two people who informed for the dreaded Department of Interior Security. Everyone knew that they had to be very careful what they said. In the middle of the day today, Mohammed Salem Garib was on the air talking about solidarity among the protesters and thanking them for the calm in Tobruk. Behind him was a large red, black, and green flag. This flag was used in the time of the monarchy before Gaddafi came to power, and now it's the new symbol of the Libyan revolution. Free Tobruk Radio is on the air 24 hours a day. No one is getting paid. Additional volunteers have joined the station as reporters. Salaf Fuad is a petroleum engineer at the local refinery, but the 52-year-old has started writing news reports for the station about the anti-Qaddafi protests.
Now we need only freedom, not for us. I'm old man, okay? But we need a new life, a new air, you know? And we need a good life for our children.
Fuad lived almost his entire life in a Libya ruled by Muammar Gaddafi. He beams with excitement as he talks about the prospect of handing his children a very different country where the press and the people don't live in fear of the government. Jason Bobian, NPR News, Tobruk, Libya.
The King's Speech ruled over last night's Academy Awards ceremony, winning 4 Oscars, including Best Picture. NPR's Mandalay Del Barco was backstage at the Kodak Theater and reports that other winners were for movies about ballerinas, fighters, dreamers, and toys.
The King's Speech was crowned Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay. It earned Oscars for Best Director and Best Actor. It's the real-life story about King George VI and his speech therapist.
You do have a flabby tummy, so we'll need to spend some time strengthening your diaphragm. Simple mechanics.
Fine.
Jack and Jill.
Went up the hill.
Went up the hill.
The therapist helps the king overcome a speech impediment to lead his people through World War II. Writer David Seidler, who won the Best Original Screenplay Award, says he was able to get past his own childhood speech issues.
I accept this on behalf of all the stutterers throughout the world. We have a voice. We have been heard. Thanks to you, the Academy.
When Colin Firth picked up his Oscar as Best Actor, he joked,
I have a feeling my career's just peaked.
Backstage, Firth said he's not happy that the R-rated movie has a new PG-13 cut. The new version mutes out the F-word in a key scene uttered by the Duke of York.
But in the context of this film, it could not be more edifying, more appropriate. It's about a man trying to free himself through the use of forbidden words. And he's so coy about it. I mean, I just can't. I still haven't met the person who would object to it.
During the telecast, Academy Awards censors muted out the same word during an exuberant speech by a stunned Best Supporting Actress winner, Melissa Leo.
Yeah, I am kind of speechless. Golly sakes, there's people up there, too. When I watched Kate 2 years ago, it looked so...
Backstage, Leo apologized for her profanity.
I had no idea. Those words, I apologize to anyone that they offend. There's a great deal of the English language that is in my vernacular.
In the film The Fighter, actor Christian Bale plays Leo's son, a twitchy, small-time boxer and crack addict. During his acceptance speech, Bale thanked the ex-boxer whose life he depicted, Dickie Eklund. Bale later told reporters that before the ceremony, he had gone out drinking with Eklund and missed out on Leo's Oscar moment.
Because they wouldn't let me in. I was literally banging on the door with Dickie going, "Can let us in?" And they wouldn't let us in. So that was just my mistake. I'll know better if I ever return to an Academy Awards. I miss the F-bomb, but you know what? I've laid down many of them myself before.
The winner for Best Actress spent a year studying ballet to depict the intense and emotionally disturbed ballerina in The Black Swan.
Natalie Portman.
He picked me, Mommy. Do you hear me?
Natalie Portman accepted her Best Actress Oscar by thanking her parents, her director, and the principal dancer with the New York City Ballet who trained her. They're now expecting a child.
My beautiful love, Benjamin Millepied, who choreographed the film and has now given me my most important role of my life.
Backstage, one reporter asked the visibly pregnant Portman what it felt like to win the award.
It feels very, very dreamlike right now. I don't really know where I am, I suppose.
And would it be too crazy to think that you might name your baby Oscar?
I think that's probably definitely out of the question.
The film Inception won 4 awards last night for cinematography, sound editing and mixing, and visual effects. Paul Franklin, who supervised the effects, was asked to compare winning the Oscar to the excitement of folding Paris in half, as he did in the movie.
They're both dreamlike situations, and as I say, I'm hoping I don't actually ever wake up from this one.
The Social Network, a film about the founders of Facebook, won 4 Academy Awards last night, including Best Original Score. Trent Reznor, leader of the industrial rock band Nine Inch Nails, composed the music with his collaborator, Atticus Ross.
It may encourage a number of artists that haven't thought in terms of rigid discipline of film scoring that there's a possibility out there to work in film and make something interesting and a bit different.
Aaron Sorkin wrote the Oscar-winning screenplay, which he conceded took more than a few jabs at Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg.
I think he's been an awfully good sport about this. You know, I don't think there's anybody here who would want a movie made about the things they did when they were 19 years old. And if that movie absolutely positively had to be made, you would want it made only from your point of view, and you wouldn't want included also the points of view of people who are suing you for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Sorkin said he'd been cranky about the internet, but has been encouraged by social media mobilizing people in Cairo and other places. The nearly 4-hour telecast had quite a few references to the internet and Twitter and mobile apps. It even included an auto-tune music video mashup, all designed to attract a younger TV audience. That was also the reason for choosing this year's co-hosts, the eager Anne Hathaway and rather casual James Franco.
Anne, I must say, you look so beautiful and so hip.
Oh, thank you, James.
Yeah.
You look very appealing to a younger demographic
as well.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Franco and his mother tweeted about the Oscars while his grandmother waved to rapper Marky Mark Wahlberg from the audience, and Anne Hathaway's mother jokingly admonished her to stand up straight. But it might have been Tom Hooper's mother who made the most impact at last night's ceremony. In accepting the award for Best Director, Hooper said his mother had first seen a play reading for the King's Speech at a fringe theater in London.
Thank God she did, because she came home, rang me up and said, "Tom, I think I found your next film."
Hooper says she had to remind him repeatedly for 4 months to read it before he finally did.
And the moral of the story is, listen to your mother.
Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Hollywood.
Our Oscar coverage continues online, including contributions from blogger Linda Holmes and the folks at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. They've got a feature here with photos from the red carpet. They say it's style commentary from people who have none. It's at npr.org/Oscars. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep. The billionaire investor Warren Buffett is sounding an optimistic note about the economy. He made the comments over the weekend in his annual letter to shareholders of his company Berkshire Hathaway. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
As usual, Buffett's letter was a mix of personal anecdotes, investment advice, and frank assessments of Berkshire Hathaway's holdings. Profits were up sharply in the last quarter of the year, he said, partly due to his acquisition of the railroad company Burlington Northern Santa Fe, which had worked out much better than he expected. He said he believed a housing recovery will begin within a year, which will benefit Berkshire Hathaway companies that make related products like bricks and carpets. He said he was looking for ways to spend some of Berkshire Hathaway's $38 billion in cash and was likely to acquire new companies. He wrote, "Our elephant gun has been reloaded and my trigger finger is itchy." He also wrote, "Throughout my lifetime, politicians and pundits have constantly moaned about terrifying problems facing America. Yet our citizens now live an astonishing 6 times better than when I was born." Buffett also revealed a bit more about his succession plans, saying investment manager Todd Combs had been hired to begin managing a small part of Berkshire Hathaway's asset portfolio. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Here at home, many of the nation's governors gathered in Washington over the weekend. Most share a common problem: budget shortfalls. As they try to find a way to balance their budgets, many are looking at the Medicaid health program for the poor. NPR's Julie Robner reports on the latest fight between the states and the federal government.
Since the feds and the states share the costs of Medicaid, arguments between the two about its rising costs aren't exactly new.
Medicaid cost growth has been a problem for time immemorial.
Alan Weil is executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy, but he says this time things are different.
One is the program is bigger, and so growth on a larger base is more real dollars that it's harder to find.
Indeed, enrollment in Medicaid in recent years has outstripped its better-known sibling, Medicare. Medicaid today covers some 60 million low-income Americans, mostly pregnant women, children, seniors, and those with disabilities. A second problem, says Weil, is that this particular economic downturn is lasting a lot longer than many economists predicted. That means not only less revenue coming in for states, but more people qualifying for Medicaid. Congress had been giving the states extra money for Medicaid, but it's about to end as of this July 1st.
So if the federal government would continue its support for states for another year or two, we probably wouldn't be hearing what we're hearing now. But basically, the federal support is ending a little bit too early relative to when state revenues are picking up.
That was a common theme sounded by governors gathered in Washington this weekend for the state executive's annual winter meeting. Here's Iowa Republican Governor Terry Branstad.
"I had to come up with $540 million to plug the Medicaid hole because of the one-time stimulus money and other one-time state money that was used."
And here's Dennis Smith, the former head of the federal Medicaid program, who's now in charge of Medicaid and other health programs in Wisconsin.
"It's going to be about $600 million over 2 years period of time. So we have to make up that money for ourselves without really helping anyone or making any changes."
But what really makes this Medicaid fight different from ones that have come before is the impact of the new health law. That law calls for a huge expansion of Medicaid in 2014 to low-income childless adults. Actually, the states won't be on the hook for most of those costs. All but 10% will be paid by the federal government. So what's the problem then? Between now and 2014, the next 2.5 years, in order to get that federal money, governors basically can't cut back on most Medicaid eligibility. That makes a lot of them, well, not very happy. Again, Iowa's Terry Branstad.
I really believe that the federal government, with their maintenance of efforts, have really tied our hands and not given us the flexibility to do what we do. I don't mind being held accountable. I'd like to be able to set our own eligibility requirements.
But not every governor is finding the new health law a negative for its Medicaid program. Minnesota's actually adding low-income adults to Medicaid this year, 3 years early. New Democratic Governor Mark Dayton says that's because the state was already providing insurance to those people, but using only state dollars. So it will actually save money by getting the federal government to kick in a share.
The easiest decision I've had to make in my first 2 months in office.
And while Republican governors continue to argue that the health law is hurting their budgets, Maryland Democratic Governor Martin O'Malley argued just the opposite.
I think governors have never had more tools to bring down the costs of health care than we do right now because of technology and the flexibility of the Affordable Care Act.
Late last week, federal officials signaled they would give the state some more flexibility to waive the requirements that they maintain Medicaid eligibility if they can show they would otherwise run a budget deficit. Many governors, however, say they want still more flexibility to decide who to keep on Medicaid and who or what to cut. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.